The masters almost surely have a plan. There's clearly maybe something there beyond the realm of man. And until you've thoroughly tested every last close trusted view, I find the more you think you know, the less you really do.
That's true, Dr. Zaius.
Very well.
Where would we be without THC? Cause we know they're lying to us, just don't know.
All right, folks, we know there are many tools used against the masses by the nefarious few atop the power pyramid, and nearly every facet of our reality has been tweaked and twisted to achieve a desired result at our expense. Well, for my money, there are few areas where these manipulations are more apparent than the modern music industry, and when you hold your mental magnifying glass to the last 50 or 60 years of Western music, you'll see mental conditioning, the application of MKUltra techniques, blood sacrifice, cultural degradation, magic, child abuse, assassination, Manchurian candidates, predictive programming, body doubles, and rituals and symbols that have been used since ancient times, all thinly veiled behind a couple of catchy tunes. It can be a lot to unpack, and lucky for us, today's guest, Mark Devlin, has not only studied and researched this material at length, but he also has a personal connection to the field through his successful career as a UK DJ. He's also a podcaster and the author of a lengthy, lengthy expose of everything sketchy in the music world entitled Musical Truth, and he's here to talk about it today. Mark Devlin, welcome to THC.
Hey, Greg. Great to be on. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, man, this is a real pleasure. Thanks for reaching out. This book really does cover all the conspiratorial madness of the music world across multiple genres and time periods. And it goes beyond that into other material about natural law and consent that I was really surprised to see ties in so nicely. But this is great, man. I do like these music and magic shows, and I haven't had a guest who's really in the music industry since Professor Griff, and he's quoted several times in the book, which is awesome. But I'm curious how much of these things you saw personally in your music career as opposed to other subjects that I'm sure just came from the research side of things. Maybe we can start there.
Yeah, well, not a whole lot, to be honest, in terms of personal experience of the things that I've written about in the book. Most of it is as the result of research and as the result of looking at the work of other authors and writers, such as Professor Griff and many others. There's a couple of anecdotes I relate in the book of a couple of kind of dark supernatural experiences that I had, which ties into some of the stuff that I'm talking about regarding Satanism. I had a very, very memorable experience in a Prague hotel room in the Czech Republic once, which was pretty unsettling. And I had another unusual experience at about 3 o'clock in the morning in a radio studio when I reversed a Madonna record and the resulting recording made me jump out of my skin. So I've related those two stories in there. But the rest of it has just been as a result of delving into this information. And it's about 5 years worth of research since all this stuff first came across my radar. I've been immersing myself in it big time and just trying to consolidate it all and make sense of it all and bring it all together. And that was the aim with the book, to just show how all these different facets fit together. Because you can find YouTube videos where people talk about backmasking, subliminal messages hidden in reverse in audio recordings, in Beatles records or Led Zeppelin records or whatever. And then you've got somebody else talking about mind-controlled artists, MKUltra, Monarch programming, and how the likes of Britney Spears and Miley Cyrus may well be victims of this. And then you could have another guy talking about symbolism in a Jay-Z video, and why is Jay-Z throwing up this triangular hand sign? And they're all kind of standalone when you find them online. And although it's fascinating to look into these things, it doesn't explain how it all connects in together and what the motivation is behind any of this stuff being done. So the intention with the book was to show how it does all fit together like a massive jigsaw puzzle. Mm-hmm. And to just convey to people how important it is to understand what's being done to us on a subliminal mind control level. And only when we understand it can we resolve to do something about it. So, yeah, very, very little by way of personal experience, I would say, apart from having been a DJ for the past 25 years. And when I first started out as a hip hop DJ in the 90s, I was playing a lot of the music, which I can now see with the benefit of hindsight and research and maturity, was part of this agenda, which was being laid out and unveiled stage by stage. And I played my part in that by playing the records out in clubs, playing them on radios, writing about them in magazines. But little did I know back then what it was all a part of. I was completely oblivious to the agenda. And it's only in recent years that I've come to understand all that.
Yeah, and you said that noticing the repetitive use of symbols in the music industry is one of the main things that brought you to this work, and no doubt it's there, but what symbols and meanings do you find to be like the best examples to drive home the idea that something strange is going on in the entertainment world?
Well, you can look at music videos of the past few years from all the A-list artists, and I'm talking the likes of Jay-Z, Kanye West, Rihanna, Beyonce, Katy Perry, Lady Gaga, Miley Cyrus, Britney Spears, Kesha, those kind of artists. And you find the same symbols cropping up time and time again. You see many depictions of pyramids, and it can just be a pyramid shape or symbol just flashed on screen for a split second. It can be what I just mentioned, somebody like Jay-Z or Kanye West holding up a sort of pyramid sign with their fingers, making that symbol. You know, what's that all about? Mm-hmm. And then you have depictions of demonic entities that get spliced into music videos for just a split second at a time. You see snakes everywhere. You see depictions of Baphomet, this androgynous goat-like entity that has been revered by various dark occult secret societies through the ages and is taken to be an emblem of Satanism. And all this stuff is going into music videos, which are watched predominantly by young people. Kids, you know, in many cases.
Right.
The target audience for the average Rihanna or Beyonce video is girls of sort of 9, 10, 11, 12 years of age. So what is this stuff doing in there? And when you get into videos like Beyonce's XO and Robin Thicke's Get Her Back, you find that there are images of these demonic entities that appear on screen for a fraction of a second. And to know that it's there at all, you've got to have one of these videos and be able to freeze frame it very, very quickly and just catch that instant this thing appears. And then you can study it and see what's been going into the subliminal minds of the viewing public, because all this symbolism is aimed at the subliminal mind, which is where symbolism lives. The language of symbolism resides there. And the subliminal mind is absorbing all these millions of pieces of information every second. And it all goes below the threshold of conscious logical analysis. So the conscious mind is not aware that all this stuff is being taken in. And it's only when it's pointed out and explained to the conscious mind what's being done to it that you can realize that this has been taking place. Otherwise, it just gets lodged into the subliminal and it ends up having an effect on the thoughts and emotions and behaviors of that individual. So these music videos really are having that kind of effect. And psychologists will confirm that that is the power that the subconscious mind has. And a few years ago, I would have scoffed at this, like I'm sure many people will when they hear it for the first time. And I would have written it all off as wild fantasy. And I would have said, nah, this can't happen. It's just people's imagination. But when you actually do the research and when you actually approach this with an open mind, without any ulterior motives and without any belief systems to defend, you discover that this stuff really does have an effect on the human psyche and on human consciousness. Why else would it be getting done? You know, why are demonic entities in Robin Thicke videos when they have no relationship to the lyrics? Why are the forces that control the music industry bothering to put all this stuff in? There has to be a reason for them doing it. You know, it goes way beyond the realms of coincidence that these same symbols keep cropping up in videos and in stage shows like the US Super Bowl and the Grammys and in promotional photo shoots and all of that. You know, way beyond coincidence, there is definitely something going on here.
Mm-hmm. Well said, man. And I do love the angle that you've shown that these entities are actually embedded in the music videos, because I watched one of your presentations that shows some examples of that, of these little things in the frame. And that is just wild to me. I haven't heard a lot of other people go into that, because otherworldly influence of entities interfacing with our world is an area that I'm really interested in. And it was great to see that.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, this ties into a lot of the stuff that you get into on your show. And there are other researchers that have looked into this stuff. There's a guy called Isaac Weishaupt, which is an interesting name. And he runs Illuminati Watcher, the Illuminati Watcher website. And he put out a book called Sacrifice Magic Behind the Mic. And he really went into this whole thing about the possible demonic possession of some of your favorite artists.
Right.
And it's really hair-raising stuff, you know, and he did a great job of researching that. And there's also a website called Vigilant Citizen, vigilantcitizen.com. And the guy that runs that site really gets into the analysis of all this dark occult symbolism that appears in music videos and such. And he gets into a lot of the mind control symbolism as well.
Right.
And all these little motifs and icons which hint at the presence of monarch programming and trauma-based mind control with some of your favorite artists. So there are other researchers that have really gone into this. And when you look at their work and you kind of consolidate it and bring it all together, you realize that the music industry, at least at its very upper corporate levels, I'm talking all the big A-list household name artists that we all know, it's a very dark place. And there's some really sinister, malevolent stuff going on behind the scenes. Satanism is absolutely rampant, and other dark occult practices. And there are indicators and little calling cards everywhere you look for those with the eyes to see. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a kind of subliminal language that's being communicated here. But when you learn to spot the signs, you see it everywhere.
For sure. And it's clearly ramping up. And I know people have always kind of been coming down on music. You know, it's kind of a motif that whatever generation you're in, your parents just don't get the music. You know, people always talk about that. But I mean, it's pretty clear to see that, you know, when I was growing up, we had things like Christina Aguilera and Britney Spears, and people were like, oh, well, Britney Spears has this Hit Me Baby One More Time video, and she's in a schoolgirl uniform in a high school, and this is really sexualizing high school kids, and it's not appropriate. And I mean, I get that. But then you look at today, and you mentioned Robin Thicke. He has that Blurred Lines video with Miley Cyrus. I thought that was pretty risque. But then also, or that performance that he did, and his video is risque too. But the worst of it is the most recent Miley Cyrus video I saw, where she's actually like in a baby crib in a diaper and talking about sex. And I was like, wow, where do we go from here? The fetus talking about sex in the womb?
Yeah. It's crazy. Every time you think they've sunken as low as they possibly can in terms of degrading morals, they go and surprise you by taking it even further. And we've seen this continuing over the past few years. They just get down into the dregs of the cesspit ever more in terms of all this stuff. And it's gradually normalizing all of this type of imagery to a new generation, because young people now that are growing up with these kind of videos, the sort of stuff they're seeing, it's normal to them because it's all they've ever known. They don't have any kind of moral compass to gauge how things used to be and to have seen the degeneration happening over a number of years. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's just conditioning a new generation to entirely accept this stuff. And I'm reminded of when Eminem first came out. And I'm sure a lot of people listening to this will recall when Eminem's first album dropped
right.
in 1999, the Slim Shady album. The sort of stuff that was on that at the time was absolutely shocking, because it's the first time that anyone had heard it. He was talking about murder and mutilation and rape and slitting the throat of his baby mother in front of his daughter and taking his daughter out with him to dump the body in a lake and, you know, drug abuse and all kinds of outrageous stuff. And the first time you hear all this, it's absolutely shocking. But by the time you've got to Eminem's second album and you've heard him talking about this stuff on five or six singles, it becomes, oh, Eminem, he's such a character, isn't he? Here he is again talking about rape and murder and mutilation. What is he like, eh? Oh, he's such a card, you know. And before you know it, that's been normalized. And a few years down the line, people were saying, oh, Eminem, it's really boring. All he ever talks about is rape and torture and murder. You know, right. It's surprising how you can normalize this stuff if you just keep bashing people over the head with it. And, you know, you mentioned that Miley Cyrus video, and she's also been pictured on stage giving a blowjob to a bloody blow-up doll, an inflatable doll,
right.
in a concert that was attended by young girls. And, of course, she was straddling that wrecking ball in the wrecking ball video. And then you've got Rihanna making songs like S&M, talking about whips and chains excite me, and Rude Boy, come on, Rude Boy, get it up, and all this sort of thing. And these are all listened to by young kids. And I'm a parent myself. And when you become a parent, particularly when you're the parent of young girls, it really does place it all in a different kind of perspective. from a moral point of view. And where 10 or 15 years ago, you might have written it all off as just a bit of fun. You know, when you approach it from that responsible perspective, you realize that this stuff really is not good. It's not a great idea for kids to be exposed to all this stuff. Mm-hmm. And so you think, what are these corporations thinking of putting out this material? How can this be passed and considered acceptable if there isn't some kind of nefarious agenda to corrupt morals and mind control and bring about certain, you know, mind states mm-hmm. in an entire generation through this music? And of course, that's exactly what's going on.
Right. And let's go back a bit in history and talk about where some of these themes showed up in the old days, because to quote your book, you say, "The dark manipulations of the music business are as old as the industry itself, and early examples of the dubious calling cards evident in the contemporary scene are equally present in its formative years. Mind control, military intelligence, pedophilia, and occult fascination are, it seems, nothing new." Talk to us about the history there. Where do we see these things in the early stages?
Well, when I first started researching all this material, I did make the mistake of thinking that it was something that had just happened in recent years. And when I first got alerted to all this, I was studying things like, you know, Jay-Z videos and Britney Spears and stuff like that. And I was going back about 10 years to kind of 2005, 2006. And I tended to think that that was when the agenda started. But the more I delved into it, and you know what it's like when you start doing research, you watch one YouTube video and you get led to another researcher's work. And then that researcher recommends you look at this blog site and then you look at this person's book. And before you know it, you're just down a very deep rabbit hole
right.
and you're absolutely drowning in information. And that's the way it was for me writing this book. And I came to realize that I needed to revise my time scale in terms of how long all this stuff has been going on. And I came to realize it does literally go back to the very first days of the entertainment industry, the corporate music industry on both sides of the Atlantic. So in the US, that would be pretty much the emergence of Elvis Presley and the rock and roll era going onwards. Mm-hmm. And going into the 60s, it dovetails into the whole hippie era, the counterculture and anti-establishment scene of the mid to late 60s. And that's where we get into the artists that came out of Laurel Canyon in Los Angeles. And, you know, maybe we could talk about that in a while. Mm-hmm. And then back in the UK, it would be names like Cliff Richard, who is an individual that's been in the headlines over the last couple of years. I don't know how much folk in the US are up on that, but Cliff Richard has been investigated by police over an alleged assault on a child at a religious Christian rally dating back to 1985 in Sheffield in England. And it also involves the famous evangelist Billy Graham. So there's an ongoing investigation into this, and it's recently expanded, and there are apparently two other cases that police are investigating allegedly involving Cliff Richard. And we have to be careful because, of course, nothing's been concluded yet, so it's all alleged. But yeah, that casts Cliff Richard in rather a different light to this squeaky clean sort of household name, wonderful Christian singer persona that he's labored under for many years. And in the early days of the British industry, we have, of course, the Beatles and the Rolling Stones. But there's a fascinating article that I draw attention to in the book that was written by a former British intelligence operative who went by the name of T. Stokes. And he put out this article that was later expanded upon and sort of embellished by a British writer called Chris Spivey. And it details this incredible, amazing, interconnected labyrinth of synchronistic links between some of the prominent musicians in those early days of the British industry. So we're talking the Beatles, the Rolling Stones, we're talking big time prolific record producers like Brian Epstein for the Beatles, and Joe Meek, and Kit Lambert, Robert Stigwood. And this article shows how there are links going into military intelligence, MI5, MI6, going into high level political figures at the very top of the establishment, MPs like Tom Dryburgh, the Tory peer Lord Boothby, who was very heavily linked to Cliff Richard. There are links into the wartime Prime Minister Winston Churchill. There are links to the Cray twins, these notorious East End gangsters that had London in the grip of fear in the 1960s. And it talks about rent boys and paedophilia and murder and satanic ritual abuse and suicides and accidental overdoses. And you come to realize that throughout the history of the industry, all these elements have been present. And there are all these amazing links between all these different characters. And it really is a mind blower. But the most consistent things throughout have been the presence of military intelligence links and military intelligence organizations and links to the Secret Service and various other government departments, very heavily connecting in to the music industry and many of its key players, producers and musicians. A large number of individuals who identify themselves as Jewish, and I always make the point that it's not anti-Semitic to point out that a very large number of people that identify themselves as Jewish just happen to have been in control of these industries for decades. You know, it's a very large out-of-proportion number to the amount of Jewish people there are in society generally. Mm-hmm. So I think that's something worth looking into, and a question worth asking is, why would that be? There's paedophilia everywhere and child abuse everywhere, all these very unsettling links. And it's just incredible when you really get into it. And why should any of this stuff be connected to the music industry when it's supposed to be all about having fun, letting your hair down at the weekend, enjoying some leisure time? That's what music is supposed to be. It's not supposed to have any of these dark and malevolent links to it.
Right.
And so that article that I cite by T. Stokes is a real hair raiser. And I'd certainly recommend anyone that wants to delve into this subject area fully has a look at that and really, you know, allows their mind to be blown.
For sure, man. And you mentioned Laurel Canyon, and Dave McGowan was a great researcher in this realm who I never really got to have on before he passed last year. And you did think you thanked him in the book, and you talked about his work a great deal too. What did you learn from him?
Oh, a whole lot. I had Dave McGowan on my podcast a couple of years ago, and I was very grateful that I got an opportunity to do that because, as you say, he passed away last year on the 22nd of November, incidentally, which is a very interesting date for conspiracy fans, being the anniversary of the Kennedy assassination.
Right.
But yeah, Dave McGowan's work into the background of many of these artists that emerged out of Laurel Canyon has been absolutely invaluable to researchers in understanding all the links that there have been to military intelligence operations and the music industry. And so McGowan started this web series in 2008, and he later put out a book. He just managed to get the book out not long before he died, actually, Weird Scenes Inside the Canyon. And he details the fact that when you take pretty much every prominent, prolific, influential artist that emerged out of the Laurel Canyon scene in the mid to late 60s, and this would be the hippie movement, so-called, counterculture, that whole scene. Mm-hmm. When you look into the family backgrounds of all these artists, you discover that almost without exception, they all came from a background in military intelligence, in the armed forces, in the Secret Service, or in some other aspect of the government, government departments, whether it's CIA, FBI, DEA, whatever. The classic example is Jim Morrison, who has always been lauded as this iconic, legendary figure of rebellion that mm-hmm. just stood for that whole late 60s scene, the anti-war crowd, you know, the whole tripped out psychedelic scene.
Right.
Morrison was very much an icon of that. But McGowan revealed that Jim Morrison's father was Admiral George Stephen Morrison, and he just happened to be a US naval commander that was in charge of the fleet of ships that was involved in the Gulf of Tonkin incident, or non-incident, mm-hmm. which springboarded America into its long and devastating and bloody Vietnam War and claimed the lives of who knows how many people. And McGowan pointed out to me that you don't find a stranger juxtaposition between father and son than between Jim Morrison and his dad. And he also points out that Frank Zappa, who was another icon of that era and a hero to that hippie generation, his father was involved in chemical weapons research, working out at the Edgewood Arsenal. And Frank Zappa was actually born on that military base. And then he goes into the backgrounds of so many of the other artists from that scene, like the Byrds, the Mamas and the Papas, Crosby, Stills, Nash and Young, Buffalo Springfield, Captain Beefheart. There are links into the Eagles and the Beach Boys, Joni Mitchell, Joan Baez, so many others. And even actors, big Hollywood actors at the time, like Dennis Hopper and Peter Fonda, that came out of Easy Rider, there are military links to their families as well. Even Henry Fonda, when you get down to it, the famous actor. And so even the Hollywood crowd that were running around at that time and were icons in their own right, there are always links back to military intelligence. And McGowan points out that there was no music scene at all in that part of Los Angeles prior to about 1965. And then almost literally overnight, you found recording studios and music clubs just springing up out of nowhere. And there were artists coming from all other parts of the US and Canada and even Britain in some cases, all congregating in Laurel Canyon. And they started this little community. And then before you know it, you've got this massively influential scene, all this music that just really shaped a generation and changed the style of music at the time, that whole folk rock sound. And it absolutely swept that entire generation away. And yet it doesn't seem to have happened in a natural, organic way. When you look at the evidence, it all seems to have been orchestrated and manipulated by unseen forces. And so when you realize that you've got all these family connections back into military intelligence, the obvious conclusion is that that whole scene was an exercise in military-controlled social engineering and mind control. Mm-hmm. And particularly it feeds into the whole LSD scene as well, because you had characters like Timothy Leary and Ken Kesey and his Merry Pranksters going around in this psychedelic colored bus all round Haight-Ashbury in San Francisco, distributing free tabs of acid to all the kids that were hanging out there. And Timothy Leary presenting this idea that we can all explore our consciousness and go on this wonderful journey of self-discovery with LSD. So that was all tied into it as well. And then you had this whole thing about the age of Aquarius, this spiritual astrological age, which we were said to be moving into in the late 60s as well, which added an extra kind of spiritual esoteric component to the whole thing. And it just creates an amazing, fascinating scenario in that second half of the 60s, but one which, with the benefit of hindsight and research, we can now see was almost certainly controlled by these forces that have had the industry in its grip for decades.
Yeah, man, that's a great breakdown. And you talk about in the book 1966 being one of those banner years, just like 2001. And these military connections are so interesting. And I guess we should talk about 9/11 a bit, because, you know, on the show, we've talked about predictive programming of 9/11 in movies and cartoons at length, but we also see this in the music industry, and its connections that you just laid out with military intelligence make this even more interesting.
Yeah, there's a lot of links between 1966, which is a very key year in this whole story, and 2001, actually, 35 years apart. And 1966 was the year that construction started on the World Trade Center in New York. And it just feeds back into, you know, some of these other dark occult elements of 66. Just before we move on to 2001 and staying with 66, that is the year in which the replacement of Paul McCartney is said to have taken place. We may want to get onto that and talk about it in due course.
Sure.
Because there's so much to say about it. But yeah, a very key year in that sense. There's a movie by the name of Rosemary's Baby, which was directed by Roman Polanski, who was later convicted of paedophilia,
right,
which is nothing unusual in this whole story, you come to realize.
Well, the conviction is.
Yes, but the allegations aren't.
Yeah. Right.
And so Roman Polanski is tied into this whole kind of LA psychedelic era scene by way of the fact that he was married to Sharon Tate, who was one of the victims of the Manson family murders in that notorious incident in August 1969. As I say, the synchronistic links everywhere, Greg, and it just blows your mind, because you come to think that this all goes beyond the realms of human planning. And it's like there are forces in the universe that are kind of causing all these things to link together and sync together as they do. It's just amazing. Mm-hmm. So Rosemary's Baby was a movie which was presented as fiction. It was based on a novel by Ira Levin. And it was the story of this wannabe actor, this kind of struggling actor in New York that wanted to make it big but was having a hard time achieving it. And he had his young wife, Rosemary, played by Mia Farrow. And this guy falls in unwittingly with a group of Satanists operating out of this apartment block in New York where he lives with his wife. And it just happens to be the Dakota Building, outside which John Lennon was assassinated years later in December 1980. That's where this movie was based. And so he falls in with this bunch of Satanists. And the striking thing about the Satanists is that they're not obviously that on the surface. There's this old couple that masqueraders, you know, these dear, sweet old people, his neighbors. And then you've got a friend of theirs that just looks like this, you know, middle-aged, ordinary woman. And then you've got a doctor that seems to be a highly respectable physician on the surface. And you come to realize that they're all practicing Satanists and they keep their true nature well hidden beneath the surface. And I would suggest that there's a lot of truth to this movie. And far from being a work of fiction, Roman Polanski was actually presenting a depiction of what really goes on in society, where you've got these seemingly innocent covers and glossy surface veneers. But when you get beneath them, you discover that the terrible, devastating truth of what these people are really all about. An interesting thing about Rosemary's Baby is that it was released in 1968, but it was set in 1966. And you see a calendar on the wall in one scene, and it shows 1966, and the lead Satanist character describes 66 as year one. You know, it all starts in 1966. Then you discover that Anton LaVey and the Church of Satan was very much connected to 1966 as well. That was the year that that was established. And you got all these connections back to 66. So then that goes forward to 2001, 35 years later, as I said, because you had the foundations of the World Trade Center set in 66. And I should just mention, before we get into the Paul McCartney stuff, the date that is given for this apparent replacement of McCartney is described as 9/11 in 1966. And it depends which side of the Atlantic you're on as to how that date turns out, because the American way of expressing 9/11 is, of course, September the 11th. But over here in the UK, 9/11 is the 9th of the 11th, so it's the 9th of November. But either way, you've got the 9/11 there connected with 66. And then when you go forward to 2001, you get the events of September 11th, which we're all familiar with. One other thing to mention about 66, taking it back, is that you had another amazing, iconic movie that ties into this whole story. And that was 2001, A Space Odyssey, coming from Stanley Kubrick and written in conjunction with Arthur C. Clarke. And this movie was released in 68, but production started on it in 66. And isn't it interesting that the year chosen as a depiction of the future in this story concocted by Kubrick and Arthur C. Clarke, of all the years they could have chosen, was 2001. Hmm. And we've heard from so many other researchers that Kubrick was a big-time insider that had a lot of knowledge of what the master plan was, of the controllers and the elites that are pulling the strings behind the scenes in this world. So it's not beyond the realms of possibility that Kubrick could have had foreknowledge of what was to come in 2001, I would suggest. And of course, we all know what did happen, the events of 9/11. But the incredible thing about that is that when you get into the research, you come to realize that there were hundreds, literally hundreds, of depictions of the events which would happen on the 11th of September 2001, encoded into movies, TV shows, and music videos and record sleeves in the years leading up to 2001. So we're talking the 1980s and the 1990s were absolutely replete with all these representations of various aspects of 9/11. There's videos you can look at on YouTube which lay all this stuff out. And they go into Independence Day and the Terminator movies and Die Hard movies and The Simpsons even. And when it comes to the music industry, there's a record sleeve, which I always show in my public talks. And in the early days when I used to show it, you could actually hear the gasp of the audience when you put the final image up on screen and they realize what's going on. And it's an album by the British group Supertramp. And it's called Breakfast in America. And it was released in 1979. And the sleeve image to the album has a scene looking out from an airplane window coming in over the Manhattan skyline. So you can see New York Harbor. And you've got the Statue of Liberty, which is presented as this waitress, you know, serving breakfast. And you've got the word Supertramp emblazoned across the Manhattan skyline. And of course, the Twin Towers are still there in 1979. And somebody worked out, not sure how, but when you do an inversion of this image and you create a mirror version of it, you flip it round in reverse, where the letters of Supertramp appear above the two World Trade Center towers, you've now got a 9 and an 11 directly above the two towers. And bear in mind that this is a scene from an aeroplane window coming in over New York. You know, this is a very chilling premonition of what was to happen in 2001, way back in 1979. And, you know, is that a coincidence? Is that just one of those things? Is that the universe synchronistically communicating something? Or was there foreknowledge of what was going to happen? You know, we're into the realms of predictive programming now, which I'm sure many of your listeners will be familiar with.
Right. And it is an interesting realm. And you bring up a great point about the potential for otherworldly influence or involvement with these wild synchronicities. Because I had Peter Lavenda on the show fairly recently, and that's kind of his take, that there's something more esoteric going on. And I think it's worth considering that it could be more complex than just saying, for example, like, all right, we're going to have a CIA asset write a book about the sinking of the unsinkable Titan, and then we're going to use that as a template later for the Titanic. You know, I mean,
Yeah.
I think that that's kind of some people's understanding, but that might be way too simplistic.
Yeah, there's different ways you can interpret that. We're talking about this Morgan Robertson novel, Futility, which came out in 1898. And it presented all these depictions of what was to happen with the story of the Titanic, 14 years later. And when I first looked at that, my first instinct was to think, well, obviously this novelist had foreknowledge of what they were going to do. The plan was obviously in place that early, and so he somehow was privy to this information. But I guess there are other explanations or other possibilities there. Maybe when a novelist or a filmmaker or a musician puts out a piece of work and they kind of imbue it with their creativity and their intent, and they put it out there, it makes some kind of universal connection, and it goes out into the morphogenic field, and maybe it has some kind of effect on events that will come to pass. Because you hear so many authors and scholars and researchers in the field of consciousness that talk about we create our own reality, the physical reality that we experience, by our will and our intent and our imagination.
Right.
And if you wish to achieve something or experience something, you just have to imagine it into being. And so you throw your will and your intent out there into the universe, and you can actually cause these things to happen. So maybe there's an element of that going on. You know, it's certainly not impossible.
Yeah, like they put out hundreds of references to 9/11 in advance, and some, if they want to perform a ritual like 9/11, it's almost like crowdsourcing the power of manifestation, if that's possible.
Yeah, maybe you're helping to empower that scenario into being by presenting depictions of it. And also you're getting the general public to make a connection with it, an energetic connection, again, on a subconscious basis, so people don't realize it's going on. So people that were watching the Terminator movie and Independence Day back in the 90s, and they saw these little split second images, again, just like the music videos from earlier. It can be a clock counting down, and it stops on 9/11. And there's a clock in the Back to the Future movie, actually, the original one, which is set on 9/11. And people have been absorbing all this stuff for decades. And some people think that when you make an energetic connection like that with a scenario that's being presented to you, large numbers of people all pooling their consciousness in that way can actually empower it and help it to come into being. So maybe there's an element of this kind of magic that was going on in the years leading up to 9/11. And maybe these dark controllers that were pulling the strings of it all understood how that works. And it's important to realize that when you get to the top of the pyramid, if you want to use that analogy, the control structure, the individuals and the groups that control governments and that control all the big corporations, that control all the educational establishments, schools, colleges and such. They control the military, they control all the scientific establishments. They also control the entertainment industry, you know, Hollywood movies, television and the music industry. So you've got the same controllers that are pulling the strings of all these different walks of life that would have been behind the events of 9/11, but also would be able to dictate and direct and control the way that the music industry was going and the way the Hollywood movie industry was going. So if they'd wanted to put various symbolism into Hollywood movies in the years leading up to what they knew was coming, it would not have been difficult for them to achieve that.
Right. And there could be multiple reasons for all this. There are those people also who say that the elite believe that they're karmically free from all the damage and havoc they wreak if they tell us about it. And I've never really been fully satisfied with that answer, because it just seems like I don't think of the elite as having the same superstitions as they put out to us through the religious arm of the power squid. But this is probably the best example of it. It's Prince in 1998, and I don't usually splice audio into the show, but I'm going to for this because it is just amazing. I think you'll be able to hear it too, Mark.
Yeah.
Hit me. I mean,
there you go.
That's clear that he had knowledge of that event before it happened.
And that was 1998. That concert was 98. So why would he feel the need to say 2001 hit me at the end? Because a lot of people wanted to write that off by saying that in 1998, Osama bin Laden was already public enemy number one in the US because he'd had the Oklahoma City bombing pinned on him. So Prince could have been making a reference to that. But, you know, the real clincher is when he says at the end, 2001 hit me.
Right. And another thing that points to knowledge of that event is Dr. Dre's album released in 99.
Yeah, well, I did think that was the case because he put out an album called The Chronic 2001. In 1999. And I thought, well, why would he call it 2001? Why would he just not call it 2000 if he was kind of evoking the new millennium? I did have that one pointed out to me by Lennon Honor, a great researcher who I've cited. Yeah, for sure. And Lennon pointed out to me that, I forget the exact details, but there was some kind of stitch up that was done towards Dr. Dre by Suge Knight, that nice man from Death Row Records. And, you know, they had a major falling out. And Suge Knight managed to get hold of the rights to put out a collection of recordings. And he was able to call it The Chronic 2000, or he was able to make some reference to 2000. And so Dre had to take it on 1 year, and he had to call his album 2001 to avoid any kind of legal clash with that particular registered name. It was something along those lines that was explained to me anyway. But, you know, even if you write off that one, there are many other advanced references to 2001, as I mentioned earlier. Mm-hmm. And just picking up on what you were saying a short while ago about the elites feeling that they can cheat karmic consequence by letting us know what they're doing in advance. This is a very key thing. And really, when you get to the end of my book and you read the last two chapters, you realize that it's the central message that I'm putting across, really, having spent the rest of the book talking about the nuts and bolts, techniques and tactics that are used. Mm-hmm. The most important message in the book resides in the last couple of chapters, where I talk about what we can do about it and why it was all being done to us in the first place. It's all about consent. It's all about having our free will consciousness hijacked, which is a gift that we have from the creative source behind the universe. As humans, we all have this gift of free will consciousness and the ability to make decisions for ourselves in terms of whether we consent to a situation or not. And it ties into natural law. And this is called many other names. It's known by many other descriptions. It's called universal law, karmic law, the law of cause and effect, consequentialism. It's had many different names through the ages. And it's the central spiritual core of all the major world religions as well, before all the dogma and all the rules and regulations were added to make the various holy books of these different religions, what lies at the very core of it all is this spiritual truth that is natural law. And the central tenet of natural law, which is set into place by the creative force behind the universe, so it supersedes any law that's been written by any man through the ages. The central tenet is basically, it could be summed up in three words, do no harm. Do not cause harm to others. Or you can expand it to do not treat others in a way you would not wish to be treated yourself. And this is the law of morality that we're all required to live by in creation. And if everyone were to observe that law, then all the things that we see manifesting in the world today, all the violence and the chaos and the mayhem and the injustice and the suffering, would simply not be there. But unfortunately, humanity has been manipulated to forget this great spiritual truth, or just not understand it and not apply it to their lives. And that's why we're seeing all the stuff play out that we do. And I believe that the dark elite controllers understand the way natural law works only too well. But they hate it. They hate the fact that they're bound by it in the same way that the rest of us are. When we're talking about these elite controllers, as you'll know, Greg, we're talking about psychopaths.
Right.
And we're talking about mentally ill individuals who are steeped in dark occult practices and Satanism, and they've had large parts of their humanity removed. The compassion has gone. The empathy has gone. They're cut off from their true spiritual nature and their true humanity through lifetimes of mind control and these dark rituals that they go through. But they still observe that natural law is in effect. They hate the fact that they stand to bear the karmic consequence and reap the results of their actions if they do all their various fuckeries to us against our consent. And so what they try and do is manipulate our consent by hijacking our free will consciousness. And they do this by telling us effectively what they're doing and what they plan to do. And this is where predictive programming and all this symbolism comes in. So they present to us what they plan to do, but they put it in deeply encoded cryptic form. They use symbols, they use numerology, and they know that the vast majority of humanity are not going to understand what's going on. 99% of people, it will go into their subconscious mind, and they have no idea what's being depicted. And they seem to think that when we don't object and we don't say, hang on a minute, we know what you plan to do, we're not happy with it, you can't do this, they take it as a green light to go right ahead and do it because they've done no harm. They've not broken that golden rule of not harming others, because when someone consents to a situation or they don't object to it, you've done no harm, as they see it. I would suggest it's a very twisted and warped way of looking at it, and they've not understood how natural law really affects our lives. But then again, we are talking about mentally ill psychopaths, so let's not expect too much of them. But I really do believe that this is their belief system, and this is why they communicate all this stuff to us.
Right. I mean, it's a slippery slope, and I do see what you're saying, and the examples of it are very clear. You can extrapolate that that's what's going on, but the fate of your eternal consciousness seems like too valuable a thing to gamble on these cryptic messages. I mean, you know, who decides if they told us enough? You know, they layer these things so deep in media and art. I don't see at the point of them dying, them being like, well, look, I told them, I'm not responsible for that. Like, where's the line between telling us and not telling us? Because it's so embedded that it definitely isn't obvious.
Yeah, well, something's got to account for the fact that they do all this stuff all the time. Something's got to account for this phenomenon of predictive programming.
That's true.
And, you know, if somebody's going to throw out that explanation that I just offered there, then there's got to be an alternative explanation to it, because a lot of time and energy gets expended in making sure this stuff gets spliced into these movies and these videos. What could be considered so important to them to make all that effort worthwhile? And they do always seem to give us the opportunity to know and to object if we choose. So it all ties back into the hijacking of free will consciousness. I've made the point in the book that when you get some politician, Obama or David Cameron or whoever, and they stand up there making a public speech and they tell us that we're going to be going to war with some foreign nation, Syria or whatever, they'll always concoct or present some bullshit excuse for why they're going in there. Oh, we've got to free the people. You know, there's a vicious dictator and he's oppressing his own people, or he might be developing chemical weapons and we've got to liberate the country. You know, they give you some bullshit reason for it, rather than just going in there, rather than just storming in there, sending the boys in and obliterating the country. I mean, they do that anyway, but they give you the excuse first. And I think that's another representation of them giving people the opportunity to say, well, no, we're not happy with this, you can't do this. So they kind of give you the opportunity for a way out. And it even trickles down to things like speed cameras. We've got speed cameras all over the roads here in the UK. Mm-hmm. But it's the law, not natural law, but governmental law, that there has to be a sign up in the vicinity warning you that there are speed cameras around. So if you then bomb past one at 100 miles an hour and you get yourself a fine and 3 speeding points, you were told that that camera was there. You were warned, but you went ahead and did it anyway. And when you get on a bus here, there's CCTV recordings happening on buses now and in public buildings. But there's always a sign up telling you that you could be filmed if you get on this bus. And so by getting on the bus, you're consenting to them filming you. You're giving away your free will consciousness in that way, or you're agreeing to it at least. Mm-hmm. And I think these are all representations of the same concept. They're letting you know what they're doing. You could argue that they're not being clear about it, that they're being deceptive about it, but there's still the opportunity to know. Another example in the book, I talk about vaccines. I'm sure we all understand that vaccines are very dangerous to human health,
right,
and they've got some very toxic, nasty things in them. And they're hidden behind all these big chemical names. You know, they have like 4 or 5 syllables, and most people have no idea what these things are, thimerosal and whatever else. But it is possible, particularly now in the age of the internet, where research is freely available to anyone that's got the will to do it, it is possible to discover some of these horrific things that go into vaccines. So you can discover that they're putting things like monkey brain tissue and aborted fetuses and chick embryos and formaldehyde and shit like that into vaccines. You have the opportunity to research this stuff for yourself. And then when your doctor tries to inject your child with some of this crap, you have the opportunity to be well informed enough to say, not a chance, mate. I'm not having that in my child's system. Thanks very much. So it's all the same thing. There is the opportunity to research these things. There's the opportunity to say no. And just the fact that people are able to decode all these depictions of predictive programming, and there are people all over YouTube that have spotted all these little signs pointing to the events of 9/11, shows that it is possible to know. And so they seem to be saying to us, you know, here's what we're doing. We know that most of you won't spot it, but some of you will. And that's our way out. That's how we can cheat karma, as they see it. Again, very flawed, a very flawed way of looking at it. But that is, I think, the way they see it.
Yeah, I mean, yours is definitely the best explanation we have. It just confuses me a little bit, because I just wonder where that line is. Because, you know, Prince disclosed some things in one of his concerts, but if you weren't in that room, you didn't know. But how deep do you think this thing goes? Does this area of research go all the way down to the birth certificate?
Well, that is another element of it, yeah, because when you get into the birth certificate, that is their way of tricking us into consenting to being treated as corporate entities by the Crown Corporation of the City of London. And when you really do the research in that field, you realize that that is exactly the status that most people now have in their eyes. There's a corporate version of yourself which is created, and it is owned by the Crown Corporation. And they do things like trade stocks on you and on the stock market and all this sort of stuff. Most people have absolutely no idea this is going on, because it's done by trickery. and deception. And of course, it's your parents that sign that birth certificate for you and sign you into this system of slavery, so that for the rest of your days, unless you find a way of unplugging from the system, which people now are, you're obliged to pay taxes to the government and you're seen as owned property. And again, I would just say that in this age of freely available information on the internet, you could argue that there's no excuse for people not understanding this now.
Fair.
You know, 20 or 30 years ago, when you would have had to have gone to some obscure library to have done this kind of research, and there were very few people in the world that understood the nature of the trickery, you know, you'd have a very good excuse for not understanding what was being done to you. But anyone can do the research now, and anyone can come to an understanding of how we've been tricked and lied to in this way, and they can resolve to detaching themselves from it if they can find a way to do that. You know, it's an incredible time in which we live, where we do have access to all this information and we do have the opportunity to research it. And so people being ignorant of all this stuff is no longer an excuse, really. There's no excuse for not doing your homework when what's at stake is, you know, the future of humanity itself, really, not to sound too overdramatic about it.
No, man, I'm right there with you. And to go to into another example of entities involved in music, let's talk about Elton John a little bit, because he's an interesting case study. You mentioned him being one of many musicians fascinated with Aleister Crowley and ritual magic, and that some of his songs, such as Goodbye Yellow Brick Road, are also said to have been written in witch language, which is provocative, man. Is this like automatic writing in music?
Kind of, yeah. It's like channeling this stuff from out in the ether somewhere, from unknown forces, and allowing yourself to be a conduit for this stuff. Very similar to automatic writing. And that claim was made by a very interesting character by the name of John Todd. And he was a music industry executive in the 1970s in the US. And there's a video that you can get on YouTube where he's talking about the true nature of the industry and how all the major record corporations in the US back in the 70s performed occult rituals on the master tapes of the records that they then put out to the general public. You know, I mean, this is one guy's account of what was going on, so it may or may not be the truth, but it's definitely something for people to consider, I would suggest. And he talks in this video of meeting David Crosby. He tells this anecdote of meeting David Crosby of Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young a few years after he, John Todd, had left the industry. And he says to him, David, you know, tell me, are they still taking the master tape of these recordings down into the temple room in the record company and doing these spells on it? And Crosby says, yeah, of course, man, you know how it goes. And the story is that they would bring in a coven of witches and they would put the master tape of this recording onto an altar in this temple room that all the major record corporations had in their HQs. And then they would perform these spells and these rituals on the master tape and kind of imbue it with this negative force, this demonic entity. And the idea is that every copy that is then produced of that recording carries an aspect of that dark energy with it. And so it's going out into all the homes of the general public. Like I say, we've just got this one guy's word for it that that takes place. But when you get into the background of John Todd, he actually comes from a long-running bloodline of witches himself, who are said to be traceable all the way back to the Salem witch trials. And John Todd is he's also known as John Todd Collins and Lance. He's got these different pseudonyms, but he definitely seems to have come from this bloodline going back to those days. And he disappeared off the map a few years after making those comments. So nobody really knows if he was alive or dead, but he did make some comments about having to go into hiding because his life was in danger for having spilt the beans on some of this stuff. And he specifically spoke about Elton John, and he said that many of the records that you hear all over the radio, and it's no accident that certain tunes are heard on radio stations decade after decade. You know the way it is. There's sort of 20 or 30 records that you always hear on the radio over and above all others.
Yeah.
And he says it's no accident because these tunes are selected because they contain subliminal messages that they want to get out into the minds of the general public. And he says that many of these songs were written in witch language and the lyrics seem to make no sense on the surface of it. But if you're someone that is steeped in this dark occultic activity and you come from these satanic secret societies, you understand what these lyrics mean. And he cites some Elton John records as being examples of this. And another artist that often gets quoted in the same breath is David Bowie, because a lot of his early tunes, when you look at the lyrics, they seem to be absolute nonsense, but it's said to be a form of witch language by those that, you know, understand how to interpret it.
Right.
So Elton John is one of many that's been fascinated and infatuated with the works of Aleister Crowley. And when I was talking earlier about all these elements that crop up time and time again in the story of the music industry in the UK and the US, we shouldn't forget our old mate Aleister Crowley, because he's bloody everywhere. He's like a rock star in his own right. In fact, if you did a word count on the name that crops up more than any other in my book, it's probably Aleister Crowley. You know, you've had Jimmy Page of Led Zeppelin was fascinated with him. He brought his house, Boleskine House, on the shores of Loch Ness, famously, and lived there for 20 years. David Bowie was infatuated with Aleister Crowley and immortalized him in a couple of his tunes. Ozzy Osbourne made the record Mr. Crowley. Jay-Z, bringing it up to recent times, has been seen sporting a sweatshirt saying, "Do what thou wilt," from Crowley's "Do what thou wilt should be the whole of the law," from the Book of Magic. Elton John was into him big time. There are connections to the Beatles and very much to the Rolling Stones with Crowley. So he's had a big effect on a great number of artists through the ages. Elton John is just one of many. Elton John is said to have a whole load of books on witchcraft and dark occultism in his home. And he's also a bit keen on collecting art, which many people would describe as paedophilic. He seems to like his pictures of young children. And there's a writer called Chris Spivey in the UK, who I mentioned earlier as well. And he put out an article a couple of years ago talking about the fact that Elton John and his partner, David Furnish, were allowed to adopt two baby boys and raise them in their house, in which they have all this dark occult material and all this witchcraft art and paedophilic art and all this stuff. And Spivey says, you know, can you imagine if a regular couple, a regular working class couple, tried to adopt two baby boys and social services did a quick background check on their home, do you honestly think anyone else would be allowed to adopt two baby boys into that kind of home environment if they weren't celebrities?
Right.
And we get into something else here. Elton John is a sir, and there are a great many key players in this story who just happen to be sirs, knighted by the Queen. And the revelations that have come out of the UK in recent years about Jimmy Savile, the notorious BBC DJ and television presenter, who was exposed a few years ago as a serial paedophile, child rapist, and probably murderer and necrophiliac, and certainly a Satanist, worked for the BBC for 50 years, was knighted by the Queen twice. And this started a slew of outings of various celebrities, public figures, and politicians who were exposed subsequently as paedophiles and child rapists. And in almost all the cases, they are sirs, or they've got an OBE or an MBE or some other form of knighthood from the Queen. So what is that? Is that a coincidence? Is this just a really bad judge of character? Do MI5 keep screwing up in their background checks and they just happen to miss all this information? Or is there something more to know here?
Oh, yeah. I definitely think knighthood is a reward for serving the masters. I've been skeptical of that for a while, but I guess that's a good place to call it in. Man, we talked about, again, so much stuff. Your book is even more vast than what we could cover. I mean, we didn't even talk about hip-hop or MKUltra, Project Monarch, blood sacrifices for fame.
Transhumanism.
Right. That's a big one. And the auto-tune. A lot of meat left on those bones. So maybe we'll do this again before too long if you're down for it.
Sounds like the makings of another show to me.
Me too. So awesome, man. Well, lots of new areas to touch on in the music industry. Your book is very dense, incorporates so much of this stuff. Great job, man. Would you like to give out your links and stuff to the people before we go?
Yeah, for sure. You can get more information on the book at musicaltruthbook.com. It's available on Amazon. You can get the printed version and a Kindle version there. I'm selling signed copies for anyone in the UK that might be listening to this. I'm offering to post out copies in the UK. I'm not really doing that internationally because of all the postage costs and customs and all of that. But I'm also doing a speaking tour. Most of the dates are in the UK, and at every date there, I'll have a quantity of books with me, which I'll be selling. I'm coming to the US for the Free Your Mind 4 conference, which is happening just outside Philadelphia, Langhorne, Pennsylvania. It's the weekend of the 15th to the 17th of April. There's some awesome guests there, absolutely mind-blowing lineup of guests. If you go to freeyourmindconference.com and see some of the speakers that are going to be there over the 3 days, I'm doing a quick talk there on the book, and I'll have a bunch with me, which I'll be selling on a merchandise table. So anyone that can get to Philly in April for Free Your Mind 4, they'll be able to see me there. Do come up and say hi. Anyone that wants to get in touch, I welcome feedback by email to mark@markdevlin.co.uk. Happy to correspond with anyone, as long as they're not a troublemaking shill hater, in which case I'm not going to give you the time. But anyone else, feel free to get in touch. And yeah, it's truthbook.com, and you can look for it on Amazon, basically.
Right on, man. Yet another reason for me to try to make it out to the Free Your Mind conference in April.
Oh, man, you need to be there. I really need you to be there.
I want to, but it is on the complete opposite side of a very big country. But
yeah. But there's Greyhound buses and mega buses. I know it'd take you like a week to get there, but
that's true.
I feel it could be done.
Yeah, I'm with you. There's 1,000 reasons not to do something. If you want to do it, you can make it happen. So I'm going to try. But good deal, man. Thanks a lot, Mark. Keep doing what you do. Take care out there.
Yeah, for sure, Greg. Many thanks.
All right, people. There we have it. Squeezing in episode 5 at the last minute on the last day. Dying to get on more of a set schedule here. But man, Mark Devlin, what a great guest. Well-spoken, heavily researched, great recall for the things he studied, showed up on time, and had a good-sounding mic. I loved it. And if it isn't obvious, the care and attention and professionalism he puts into just this interview shows tenfold in the book. So if you have any interest in these types of subjects, I have to now consider Mark's book to be the top of the pile, Musical Truth. Lots of top of the pile books from good guests this month. 4, honestly, because I thought Johnny Cerucci was great on the Jesuits and his book Illuminati Unmasked, probably the best. My man Gordon White, solid magical prehistory with starships. Judy Wood has done the best job on 9/11, if you ask me. And here we have Mark rounding us out with a great show and great book on the music industry. If you ask me, those are 4 5-star shows that are all pretty diverse in subject matter, but that leaves last week's Donald Marshall show. And I have to admit that the trickster in me loves putting out a show like that and just watching the controversy. But it's not like a prank. I mean, it did serve a purpose. It had been a couple of years, and he had been saying he had important disclosures. And now we know he wrote Rebecca Black's Friday, battled a spider horse, and smashed a woman's face into some stairs. Obviously important disclosures and useful information for people who are trying to find out what's really going on in this wild world. But that's it, I guess. You know, I did leave space in the beginning of this show for this month's Money Bomb winner, but no response yet. His name also happened to be Mark in another stunning synchronicity. So Mark's out there, do check your email, but it was about $250, and I'm sure he's grateful for it. Remember to check out the Free Your Mind conference in April. I will go if I can, but if you're around that area, it is a great lineup. And of course, sign up for Plus. If you appreciate what I do and think THC stands apart from the crowd, why not get another hour of every show? I just recapped this month, and I think we did pretty solid. Today, of course, no exception. In the second hour, Mark got into Victims and Handlers, the Paul McCartney replacement conspiracy, and other interesting Beatles sagas. Also, the Rolling Stones and all the death that seems to follow them. And the 27 Club. Everybody's familiar with that vaguely, but we got into it a little deeper. Honestly, a lot more than that was talked about, but, you know, I do enough trying to convince you around here. I think if you like it, you like it. What I say in the last 5 minutes isn't going to be the deal breaker, I don't think. And man, I guess the Tavistock Institute would be pretty disappointed in my sales pitch, but maybe this will help. I did mention better on-site streaming a few weeks ago and then stopped mentioning it because I had some issues getting it dialed in. But last week was the test and now we are good. So if you have any issues getting the Plus show typically with the on-site streaming, it's now a much better option, much better experience. Of course, you can still download it and get it through your apps and all that good stuff, but I'm trying to constantly improve, as we all should be. Reflect on your weaknesses and crush them. But that's it for me. I've done my part. Your move, Satanist sorcerers of the Hollywood mind control machine. Your fucking move.
Oh no, you see, the world isn't random, it's attached to puppet strings. Control over everything. The 9 to 5 is trying to steal ya. Now don't that job seem silly? Hello, can you hear me? Or should I play back recordings from some spy agency? Wish we were younger and free. I'll be thankful when it's all exposed, the vast conspiracy. There's such a difference between us and the damned Rothschilds. It's no secret, and that the best is plus, it's done.